You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Halloween is a holiday of dressing up and getting scared, but if we're honest, it's also about the candy. We'll ask you to share your favorite and least favorite Halloween candies coming up next. Now, a recent piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel describes the, quote, almost inconceivable, end quote, failure by the U.S. to confront the COVID-19 pandemic. It says, according to a leading report, America had been the most prepared country in the world. Back in February, President Trump praised that report and assured Americans the U.S. would be able to handle whatever came along.
But we're very, very ready for this, for anything, whether it's going to be a breakout of larger proportions or whether or not we're at that very low level, and we want to keep it that way.
Fast forward to last month, another report noted that while the U.S. accounts for less than 5% of the global population, it represents more than 25% of worldwide COVID cases. It's also in the top 10 of COVID-related deaths per capita. So what happened? Our guest writes that there was a cascade of blunders, some of which go back decades, some happening in the moment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions and thoughts do you have about how the U.S. responded to COVID? What do you want to know about the nation's plans to deal with a pandemic? How much confidence do you have in the federal government to handle public health emergencies? Have your feelings on that changed as the COVID crisis has played out? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Johnson is a health science and research reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He wrote that in-depth look at pandemic preparedness in the U.S. and how it played out with COVID-19. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Let's talk about that report, pre-pandemic days, that ranked the United States as number one in the world for pandemic preparedness. What kind of things went into that?
They had a group from The Economist that went to every country and looked at records, checked every aspect, basically, of pandemic preparedness. They looked at hospital beds per capita, hospitals, doctors per capita. They looked at aspects like public confidence in government. They looked at the wealth of nations, the plans that they had in place for pandemics. We had a number of different plans at the time, including a presidential playbook. Those things all went into this calculus that was called the Global Health Security Index. And the thing of it was that although we were ranked number one, the index, the sort of message behind it got lost, which was that nobody was truly prepared for a pandemic. And that proved to bear out.
There were a couple reasons for that, some that have happened in the short term, but some, you write, that were building for years. And let's start with those kind of more chronic problems first. One thing you point out, and a lot of experts you talk to point out, was as a nation, for many years, we've been cutting funding and positions for public health jobs. What have we seen?
We lost about 50,000 jobs during the Great Recession. And while jobs in other areas of the economy came back, the public health jobs never did. We also we made significant cuts in preparedness budgets. There was emergency money set aside for pandemics and other disasters that dropped from about $1.4 billion in 2002 to $675 million in 2020. I mean, you can see how huge a loss that is. These are the kind of things, they happen over a long period of time because it's easy to put off warnings. When something's not right in front of you, as an emergency right now, it's easier to handle other things, pick other priorities. People had been warning, a lot of scientists had warned about pandemics for at least 20 or 30 years. You can find U.S. pandemic preparedness plans going back to 1978. But it's one of those things that everyone said was going to happen, but I think the public never registered with the public and certainly never registered with our leadership, with our government.
Talking to Mark Johnson from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about a piece he wrote on what went wrong in the U.S. when it came to the COVID-19 pandemic. That public health investment was one of the long-term chronic things, Mark. Another consistent theme in the shorter run is who led the response. And it seems like, correct me if I'm wrong, in our pandemic playbook, pretty much every expert you talk to, the thinking going into a pandemic was the federal government is going to take the lead. They're going to be in the driver's seat. And that didn't necessarily play out that way. Can you talk about that?
That's absolutely true. There were, on all of the different pandemic plans that I looked at, there were two themes that come up again and again. One is that all of the measures needed to be taken very, very quickly. You need to be able to react quickly to a pandemic. The other consistent theme was that the federal government should lead, should coordinate all of the response to a pandemic. It's not the kind of thing you can put on states. And a very good analogy one of the sources I talked to made was when we got attacked on 9/11, George W. Bush didn't delegate counterterrorism to the states. It would have been absurd to do that. States don't have that kind of wherewithal. We don't. It would have been a real problem in terms of coordinating what one state knew with what another state knew. They needed to have solid coordination at the federal level, and that was something that was sorely missing.
So what did that end up looking like? It was delegated, in effect, in this case, to the states, where we'd seen a decline in the number of public health jobs to begin with. What were some of the consequences of that?
Some of the consequences were that you saw states scrambling to get equipment that they should already have had. And we had a strategic national stockpile. And contrary to some of the reports that came out in the immediate aftermath of the of COVID-19 arriving, the strategic national stockpile, as this administration had inherited it from President Obama, was actually pretty well stocked. The problem was that preparedness money got cut. The amount of money that Obama had asked for in his last year as president was cut by about $20 million. And he had asked for, that was an increase that he'd asked for. In his time in office, President Trump asked for zero increase, no extra dollars. And I think that that left us in a position where we didn't have masks, we didn't have ventilators, we didn't have a strong network of federal health officials to guide the states on things like contact tracing, which can be very, very important early in a pandemic. So I think it was there was a very poor combination of things. Health had been underfunded both at the federal level and at the state level. And we'd had a change in administration where I think the threat of a pandemic just had been allowed to take a back seat in terms of priorities. I mean, it was only a threat. I think that this administration had priorities in other areas.
We're looking back at how prepared the U.S. was for COVID-19, where it dropped the ball, especially in the earlier stages of the pandemic. Mark Johnson is with us, health and science reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the preparation plans here in the U.S.? How do you feel about these thoughts that the U.S. didn't do a good job responding to COVID-19? How much confidence do you have in the federal government to effectively deal with pandemics? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the U.S. early response to the coronavirus pandemic with Mark Johnson, health and science reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. recently wrote an in-depth piece on how the U.S. was, according to one report, the most prepared country in the world to deal with the pandemic, but had a slow response that didn't follow the nation's own playbook. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Josh is with us in Eau Claire. Josh, hi.
My question is if there's been any talk at the state level of starting to create our own stockpile of materials in case the federal government in the future lets us down again.
Josh, thanks for the call. In effect, that's what states were kind of scrambling to do earlier this year, Mark.
I think it's probably not a bad idea, but it really is the federal government's job to be ready for something like this. And my guess is that after the way that this has gone, a lot of there will be many reports in the coming years that will look back at the mistakes that we made. I think the strategic national stockpile will never again be allowed to get to such a low level. I don't think that we'll be underfunding public health to the degree that we have been. My sense, I'm an optimist, but I really believe that we'll learn some painful lessons from this.
Thanks for the call, Josh. Another thing you write about, Mark, is the clock in our pandemic playbook and when events happened and what was supposed to happen in our response. How did that line up?
Well, again, we were very slow. Within the first week or so of the pandemic, the announcements from China, we knew very early on that this was a serious threat. As soon as it was clear that it was a new coronavirus and that it could transmit from person to person, that was basically the signal. And we were seeing things get really bad in the middle of January. I think a lot of people forget that. I think it was around the third week of January, there were YouTube videos of dozens and dozens of bulldozers in Wuhan building a hospital in 10 days. That's a level of urgency that a lot of public health officials here felt. But at the government level, at the federal level, it did, for some reason, it didn't signal. We should have had, within the first week or two in early January, we should have had the federal officials essentially checking with states, how prepared were they? What equipment did they have? What did they need? What was their situation like in terms of hospital capacity? Were they likely to run out of beds? The United States didn't declare a public emergency until 2 months into the pandemic. It was in around mid-March that the public health emergency was finally declared. By that time, it was really late in the game.
Let's bring on another caller now. Mark is with us in Fort Atkinson. Mark, hi.
Hello. I want to kind of echo what he says. The slowness of getting on board, but it was precipitated for political purposes. When Trump saw that it was going to be an economic disadvantage, he didn't see it as being a damage to the country as a whole. He saw it as a damage to his political prospects and to his the people that he was beholden to as far as his ability to hold his power base together. And he immediately circled the wagons and began to play into the needs of his power base and completely ignored the welfare of our country.
Mark, thanks for the call. Mark Johnson, you write about the politicized part of this and how that hurt the response.
Definitely. Just for a reminder, it was late January that the president's national security advisor told him this is going to be the most serious national security threat that you face. And we find out through Bob Woodward's book that the president made a decision to downplay the seriousness of the virus. I think this was the beginning of there being mixed messages, which was, I think, at the root, one of the most critical problems in our pandemic response. The fact that he was going around saying that this would resolve soon, we had it under control, warmer weather, it would probably go away. The need to avoid a panic, I think, to a lot of people is understandable. But I think you have to look at it this way, that the American people are adults. They're not children. And we've had to learn about hard truths before. There was no denying what happened to us on 9/11. And I think it wasn't sugarcoated. George W. Bush told us that this was going to be a long war. It wasn't going to be something that was over with quickly. In this case, I think we were being told exactly the opposite of what the CDC leaders and what a lot of our public health leaders at the state level were hearing. They were scared. And I think that it must have been very confusing for a lot of people early on.
In our last just under a minute, Mark, you talked to a lot of public health experts. Is there any sense from them that we have learned lessons, we're doing better in some ways now?
I think there is. The problem is that we've gotten, as we get closer and closer to the election, I think the need to downplay the virus among the president and his supporters has grown more and more intense. So we're starting to hear the same things that that we were told early on are being told to us with even more sort of confidence and assurance that, you know, it's over, we're rounding the corner. And at this point, I think people can see here in Wisconsin, we've had 1,788 deaths up to this point. The entire country of Japan has had fewer deaths, 1,721. That's a country of 127 million. There's only 5.8 million in Wisconsin. There is no way that we should have such a high death toll. I can only hope that in 2021, we start addressing this, most importantly, by sending out a consistent message.
And we have to leave it there. Thanks to Mark Johnson for joining us from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at U.S. preparations for pandemics leading up to COVID-19. The old saying that every vote counts hits home in a state like Wisconsin, where Donald Trump won by less than a percentage point in 2016. It could ring especially true for Wisconsin's Hmong leaders, who have been personally courted by the campaign of Democrat Joe Biden this year. As Rob Mentzer reports, Hmong activists say the stakes of the election for their community have never been higher.
When Chirkai Zhang of Green Bay and Yi Ling Zhang of Weston got to meet former Vice President Joe Biden earlier this year, the experience hit them differently. Chirkai Zhang is 79 and a veteran of the secret war in Laos. Those who know him say he doesn't lose his cool easily. Yi Ling Zhang was there as his translator, and he got swept up in the moment.
It was kind of funny because when I took him there, I was shaking. I was nervous. But I looked at him and he was as cool as, you know, as you could be, you know?
Hmong soldiers like Chirkai Zhang fought alongside American forces in the 1960s and 70s. Like tens of thousands of other Hmong refugees, Zhang came to the United States after the Vietnam War ended. Through an interpreter, Chirkai Zhang says he asked the Democratic presidential nominee to remember the contributions of Hmong veterans. Asian Americans are the fastest growing racial or ethnic group of voters in the U.S., and in Wisconsin, the Hmong are the largest Asian population. Biden's meeting with Zhang came after years of groundwork by Asian Americans in the Democratic Party seeking to cement Hmong support in Wisconsin. Even Democrats acknowledge that Hmong people don't vote as a bloc, and Republicans are reaching out to Hmong voters too. Hmong entrepreneurs are sensitive to tax or regulation issues and may be more likely to lean toward conservatives. When WPR reached out to the Trump campaign for this story, it said in a written statement that two Hmong pastors in Wisconsin have served as Trump campaign surrogates. But some of Trump's comments this year have made GOP outreach more difficult. In a speech in Duluth in September, Trump railed against refugees.
Another massive issue for Minnesota is the election of Joe Biden's plan to inundate your state with a historic flood of refugees.
Trump wasn't talking about Hmong people, but Mainza Tao of Milwaukee was one of many who heard the Hmong experience in his rhetoric.
We were former refugees. Like, that includes us, you know, and when he creates that hatred, and especially the anti-Asian attacks related to COVID, that's all coming out of his mouth as our president.
The president has repeatedly referred to COVID-19 as the China virus. In the spring, there were dozens of cases of anti-Asian harassment in Wisconsin, stemming from the false notion that Asian Americans were responsible for the pandemic. Before the pandemic, in February, the Hmong community was galvanized by news that the Trump administration was seeking to deport thousands of Hmong people who had committed crimes years or decades ago. Tao leads the Asian American Pacific Islanders for Biden coalition in Wisconsin. She says the threat of deportations touched everyone.
In the Hmong community, we all know, I mean, this is not an exaggeration, we all know somebody who runs the risk of being deported. It is that close to home for each and every one of us.
Of course, not all the issues that motivate Hmong voters are specific to Hmong people. Hmong elected officials speaking at a virtual Biden campaign event this month talked about health care protections and the COVID-19 pandemic, the same topics that animate any other demographic group. Many Hmong communities are concentrated in battleground states. Besides California, which isn't a swing state, the states with the most Hmong residents are Minnesota, Wisconsin, North Carolina, and Georgia. If the presidential race is close enough, the Hmong vote could make the difference. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, we want to know what your favorite Halloween candy was as a kid and now, and if you're stocking up for the occasion, even if there's not trick or treating. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll talk about the best and worst of Halloween candy. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new legal group plans to advocate for causes in the state through a progressive lens. We'll talk to one of the co-founders of Law Forward about the goals of their group and what they'd like to see change in Wisconsin. Now, Halloween celebrations may be scaled back this year, but big bags of candy are still filling the shelves at stores. And we want to hear from you now. We want to know your favorite Halloween treat or anytime candy treat at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let us know if you're buying candy on a Halloween scale, even if you're not giving away on a Halloween scale. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also post, as many have, on the Ideas Network Facebook page. The website Thrill List released their take on the 30 best Halloween candies of all time. The top 10, I mean, this is biased, I don't know. The top 10 are all chocolate. In the top 5, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups take number 1. Then Twix, Snickers, Kit Kat, Butterfinger. That is my wavelength, I'll say. The first non-chocolate candy on the list moved down to number 11 for Starburst. Other candies that make the list, no particular order here. Flavored Tootsie Rolls, Nerds, Twizzlers, Laffy Taffy, Sour Patch Kids, Jolly Ranchers, and Skittles. Well, how about you? What's yours? Call in at 800-642-1234. Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, hot or not. Do you like some of the less popular ones? Let us know. And again, are you buying or not? I admit I have. I made a mistake. I did not. I just got a big bag of M&Ms, not individual packages. It's easy to keep eating them. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Here are some of your responses on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ken writes, this will age me, but Smarties and Bazooka gum were the worst to me. Pennies are obviously not candy, but there was a letdown to find a handful of pennies in the bottom of the trick-or-treat sack. Mounds and Almond Joys were my favorite. Bazooka gum, yeah, I mean, you got the comic book, though, and you can keep up with the doings of Bazooka Joe, so that's cool. Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in South Milwaukee. Gary, hi.
Hi. I said M&Ms. Love them.
M&Ms, and like straight up M&Ms or peanut?
No, peanuts. I need the straight up.
All right. And I'm there mostly with you, but I wouldn't turn down the other kinds. Gary, thanks a lot for getting us started at 800-642-1234. Jeff wrote on the Ideas Network Facebook page, says 2020 has been a candy-rich year for us. Uh-oh. Halloween daily. And Linda says been wearing masks and eating candy since March. Now, here's a good one. Jill says, don't hate on me. I won't, Jill. But I actually like the peanut butter taffy in the black or orange paper, referring to, I think they're called Mary Janes. And Mark replied, when I got older, whenever I got them in my bag, I would leave them in the yard or throw them down the street. Don't do that at home, kids. Kathy said, when they go through their hall, Dad would get those. I think, doesn't one of the Central Time producers like those? JC, maybe? They're kind of weird. It's like wax in candy form. Well, you can call in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite Halloween candy. Linda joins us next in Madison. Linda, hi.
Hi.
All right. What do you like, Linda?
I like Tony's Chocolonely because they're fair trade, and any kind of chocolate that is produced fairly and not exploiting children in the slave labor industry is something I just want to support and try to advocate for.
All right. And you have a favorite flavor, dark, light chocolate of that fair trade chocolate?
Dark chocolate with almonds.
All right. That sounds great, Linda. Thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. Ryan is with us now in Platteville. Ryan, what's your candy?
Oh, yeah. I want to talk about the Baby Ruth.
Okay. You know, it's been forever since I've had a Baby Ruth bar, Ryan. Remind us what's in them.
I think it's like some peanuts and caramel and not really all that sure what but, else is in it. But
they're a top choice for you?
I don't sell them anymore.
That's right.
Choice, yeah.
Hold on. I'll have to do some internet research if I can reach over here and type while we're talking. But you think they should bring them back?
I think they should bring them back.
All right. Thanks, Ryan. We are taking your favorite and, if you'd like, least favorite Halloween candies at 800-642-1234. Speaking of least favorite, Judy wrote on the Ideas Network Facebook page, candy corn, ugh. Yeah, once upon a time I liked it, but yeah, I wouldn't give it up for candy corn anymore. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Lynn is with us in Racine. Lynn, hi.
Well, actually, one of my favorites was mentioned. It's the molasses kisses, the Mary Janes. They're not made anymore because the company that made them, Necco, got sold to Spangler. And my husband's favorite were Necco wafers, and they weren't around either, but they resurfaced this year. And Spangler is making them, and my husband says they taste like the old ones.
Now, I got to say, Lynn, my family went through a Necco wafer phase. My brother and my dad and I, you know, the multicolor and the chocolate, and it's kind of like chalk a little bit in texture, and the flavor's weird, but we loved them. And your husband, same thing?
He loves them, and his birthday was Friday, and our Walgreens had them again, and I bought him some, and he was absolutely thrilled.
Fantastic. It's little things. Lynn, thanks a lot for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. AJ joins us now in Green Bay. AJ, hello.
Good afternoon. My favorite is anything that has chocolate on it or in it. If it's any kind of chocolate, I guarantee I'm going to like it. And like with all of the sugary stuff, like Sweet Tarts and Smarties and all that stuff, to me, that is just a waste of sugar. Put it in chocolate.
I'm right there with you, AJ, and my wife is kind of the opposite. There's a lot of things she's like, I'd eat the inside of that if it didn't have the chocolate around it. So more for you and me, I guess, with the chocolate stuff, AJ.
They are fantastic. Yep.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in. Talking about Halloween candy, your favorites or least favorites. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jackie on the Ideas Network Facebook page says, best nerds, worst banana Laffy Taffy. Yeah, okay. I'm done with that. Diane joins us in Jefferson. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Hey, the Tootsie Roll Tootsie Pop?
Oh, yeah.
I never get to the center. I always start chomping on the candy beforehand.
Just like the commercials.
Yes, exactly. But it's really the smell of all the candy together that gets me every year. And whether I eat the candy or not, it's that bag or that bowl. And I put my shoes in it and I smell it. And it reminds me of my childhood.
I definitely feel that when I bring home the candy from the grocery store. Diane, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go to another caller now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to throw in my 2 cents for the Toffee candy bars, Heath bar, and its big and much better cousin, Score candy bar. I don't know even if they're made anymore because I don't eat sweets anymore, but oh my God, they're delicious.
I think I see them at the store, Score. That's like S-K-O umlaut R or something like that.
Just look up delicious.
Sounds good. Mike, thanks a lot for calling in. Appreciate it. Oh, did you have a least favorite, Mike? Oop, I said bye too soon. That's my fault. I think he had a least favorite, too. We'll assume it was something gross. How about Connie now in Whitewater? Connie, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to recommend, Connie?
Oh, those suckers that have the caramel apple and the sour apple.
Oh, those are your favorite flavors.
Yes, that's my favorite Halloween candy.
Okay. All right. I don't know. What's that?
Growing up as a child, my mother made popcorn balls every year for many years. And we'd always get those and put those in, we'd wrap them and put them in everybody's Halloween bag.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I could go with a popcorn ball now. Thanks for calling in, Connie, at 800-642-1234. Talking about our favorite and least favorite Halloween candies. Might have an answer here from a caller on a controversy. Dan is with us in Hurley. Dan, hello.
Hey, I'm happy to update. I'm 60 years old, and I found Baby Ruth in a variety pack. I'm not sure which store I bought it from, but Baby Ruth, and they were mixed in with Butterfingers and another one. I can't think of the name of the other one that was there, but I've had tons of Baby Ruth in the last month.
All right, so they do, unless you found them, you know, in an archaeological site, they are still being made, it sounds like.
Yes, they are, and they're fresh.
All right, and I looked it up. The ingredients, peanuts, caramel, milk chocolate-flavored nougat, I guess, covered in compound chocolate. And, oh, yeah, present tense, it is distributed. Okay, well, thank you so much for clearing that up. Let's see, we got time for another caller or two. Josh joins us now in Eau Claire. Josh, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
All right, what do you want to recommend? What's your candy?
Sixlets. Gotta have sixlets in the Halloween bag.
I don't know what that is.
They're little chocolate balls. They're similar to M&M's, but they come in a plastic sleeve.
Oh, okay, I think I've seen that. I guess I didn't know what they're... Oh, yeah, I'm looking at a picture now. I recognize them. I wouldn't have known the name. Okay, do they taste basically like M&M's, or are they different?
They're a little bit sweeter than M&M's. They are by far one of the best candies.
All right, thanks a lot for that call. I think one more caller, Rhea is with us in Oconomowoc. Rhea, hi.
Hi.
All right, what's your favorite candy, Rhea?
My favorite candy is Sour Patch.
Sour Patch. Now, when I was a kid, I liked sour stuff, and I don't anymore. Why do you like sour stuff like that?
I don't know. It's just sweet stuff is too sweet for me. I need something with a little more oof.
Well, that makes sense, Rhea. Thanks a lot, and thanks all of you for calling in. Well, this is lively. This is on people's minds. You can keep sharing your Halloween candy thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Andrea Anderson with a remembrance of a friend and her love of pizza farms.
Years ago, my dear friend and former colleague, Brianne Chasso, started getting really excited about pizza farms. Since she grew up on a dairy farm, the concept combined two of her many loves, pizza and agriculture. Tragically, Bree passed away earlier this month from a rare form of cancer. I never got to go to a pizza farm with her, but I'm so happy she created a Wisconsin Life story about them. We wanted to share this story to honor her work and share her joy.
When I told people I was going to a pizza farm, I kept getting the same question over and over. What is a pizza farm? So I posed that question to Pam Taylor, owner of the Nelson Stone Barn in Nelson.
A pizza farm has a lot of different connotations. Ours here, we grow our own herbs and custom make our own pizzas. So we're a little bit different than growing your own vegetables. But we try to stay as local as possible. There are some that grow their own vegetables and then go farm to table.
Taylor doesn't start serving until 5 p.m. on Saturdays, but sometimes people show up early. On the day I visited, more than 20 cars and motorcycles stretched in a line along the road. By 5:30, around 60 pizza orders had been placed. The record number of pizzas in a night is 226, set earlier this year. Inside, staff take orders, prepare dough, and sauce and top pizzas. After the bubbling pies are pulled from the oven, they're quickly sliced and delivered to customers.
Hey guys, 18?
Yep.
The Hawaiian?
Clearly, the pizza is popular, but the scenery doesn't hurt either. Golden barn walls house a seating area and herb gardens. Again, Pam Taylor.
We're mostly here just so people can come and enjoy, get a little taste of nature with your dinner. We're not a formal restaurant where you have to sit down and watch your kids. As you can see, the kids are running all over. It's a very comfortable, relaxed atmosphere. That's what I wanted.
Sometimes it feels like it's trying to say
anything. That's Heather Seacrest of Suncrest Gardens Farm in Cochrane. I try to stay out of the way as she maneuvers a pizza in her wood-fired oven with a peel on a pizza night. Seacrest bakes the pizzas in a fire-brick domed oven that looks kind of like an igloo, a very warm, tan igloo. Usually, Seacrest starts firing the oven by 11 a.m.
It was at probably 400 when we started the day, and this, when it all turns white in the inside of the oven, it's at 900 degrees and the floor is at 700 then. And so that's what we aim to cook at, is around 700, 750.
Like other pizza farms, pizza nights are only one part of Suncrest Gardens Farm. Seacrest and staff tend crops, care for animals, and prepare food shares for a community-supported agriculture program. They're busy, but Seacrest says all of the pieces of the farm fit together.
And even the ash from our oven goes back to the garden, you know, as to help with the fertilizer, you know, plan of the garden, you know, back there. So nothing, everything has its purpose and everything's used. And we've even mulched tomatoes with pizza boxes. Everything's full circle as much as we can.
The pizzas I tried were unbelievably fresh. But my favorite ingredient was something that came extra with each pie. Passion. Everyone I met is passionate about knowing where their food comes from and about using the freshest possible ingredients. Mingled with that is a connection to nature and to the farm. A trip to a pizza farm isn't just about going to grab a pizza. It's an experience and a relationship with food that's hard to get in our daily lives. That's what keeps bringing people, and me, back for more.
That was Breanne Chasso telling us about the rise of pizza farms in Wisconsin. Bree formerly worked at WPR and tragically died from cancer earlier this month. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Andrea Anderson.
Coming up, we'll talk to the co-founder of a new legal group called Law Forward about issues they want to tackle in Wisconsin and how they see themselves challenging more conservative legal advocacy groups here in the state. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, with just days left, the race for key Senate seats is tightening. Jen White has the latest on the ground from Arizona, Montana, Iowa, and South Carolina. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, it's just over a week before Election Day. A new legal advocacy group is launched in Wisconsin. Law Forward aims to be a progressive answer to more conservative legal groups like the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Among the goals of the group is to take up causes like redistricting and election security. Jeffrey Mandel is an attorney and one of the co-founders of Law Forward. Jeffrey, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What were some of the things that led you and your colleagues to start this group, Law Forward?
Well, for years, conservatives have been using Wisconsin as a laboratory to experiment with extreme legal theories and destructive efforts to undermine the institutions that make up a functioning democracy. And there simply hasn't been a strong enough resistance. And we've seen a real turning of the tide in Wisconsin in negative ways. Democracy in Wisconsin has been under assault, and our institutions have not withstood that assault as well as we'd like. So Law Forward is a concerted effort to stand up to those attacks and to protect the vital pieces of our democracy so that the government in Wisconsin can work for the people.
Now, some people, including me just a minute ago, have kind of described Law Forward as an answer or a foil or a balance to groups like WILL, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Is that a fair way to portray your group?
I think it's a fair and unavoidable view. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty started a decade ago, and they have really been a big piece of what has happened here in the Wisconsin legal scene over that decade. But they're far from alone. It's a much larger attack than that, and Law Forward looks to be a counterpoint, but to more than WILL, to the entire real conservative takeover. This has been, as I said before, the testing ground for national extreme ideas. If you look at the state of Kansas, for example, Kansas was the testing ground that the conservative movement used for its most extreme fiscal policies. And Sam Brownback was elected the governor of Kansas and put in an austerity budget. And the people of Kansas did not like that, and they have changed directions. But just as Kansas has been to fiscal policy, it's Wisconsin that conservatives have used for governance and democracy and constitutional theory. And there's a real effort to dismantle the way government works, to turn this into an oligarchy rather than democracy, and to discredit ideas, to bring back, to resuscitate legal ideas and doctrines that have been discredited for more than a century. It's really an effort to turn the clock back to the times that led people in Wisconsin to create the progressive movement. And Law Forward is here to try to prevent us from slipping back any further and to resuscitate those ideas and traditions that have made Wisconsin such a national model for a century.
What's an example of one of those legal changes that your new group would want to push back against?
Well, so one example is really standing up for the separation of powers, which has been under concerted attack here in Wisconsin for several years. The legislature didn't like the choices that the people of Wisconsin made in 2018. They didn't like the choice that the people made for who would be the next governor. They didn't like the choice the people made for who would be the next attorney general. And this need not be an issue of partisanship. The problem is not that the legislature has leaders of a different party than the governor and the attorney general. The problem is that the legislature's solution was to take powers away from the attorney general and the governor to say, not only is it our job to make the laws, but now we're also going to execute the laws, and we're going to do all of the litigating, and we are going to consolidate all of the power in our branch, and we are going to allow ourselves to decide pretty much everything about the way the state of Wisconsin runs. That's contrary to the basic ideas of our democracy. It's contrary to our understanding of separation of powers. And we've seen how dangerous it is in the last 6 or 7 months during COVID, when the legislature has refused to do any legislating. They haven't even met. And instead, what they've done is they've tried to run the state and micromanage the governor through a series of litigation efforts where they hire private attorneys using taxpayer dollars, push the attorney general out of the way and off to the side and try to run the state that way. That is not the way our democracy is supposed to work.
We'll leave it there. Jeffrey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Jeffrey Mandel is an attorney and one of the co-founders of Law Forward, a new progressive-leaning law advocacy group in Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about some of the goals of the new legal group.